much. And I would like to use the opportunity of having the last talk to thank all the organizers. I think maybe we could all clap. This has been a terrific conference. So I'm going to talk about a kind of generalized version of a moment angle complex. So generalized moment angle complexes, and this is joint work with Tony Barry, Martin Bendersky, Sam Gittler, and myself. Now, I'm about to give the definition, but many people have worked on this. This subject has a long history, and I should say, I just look around the room and I see people who've worked on this, and I haven't put their names on the board. For example, Dan is one, and I'm sure as I look around, there are many, many more. So let me just say that in some sense, the first case that I'm aware of started off with some work of Tudor Gania, and then Gerald Porter in his thesis in 1965 gave examples of something. He didn't call it anything, but it turns out it was precisely a moment angle complex. So he was a student of Bill Browder, and I think they were generalizing a theorem of Gania. Then Vinberg also studied analogous constructions. Goreski and McPherson calculated some of their cohomology. Then there was this really beautiful paper by Davis, and I'm probably going to goof up the pronunciation, Januszkiewicz, on moment angle complexes and toric varieties. And then also, I see I've left off a paper. There's some work of Mike Davis and Ruth Charney on other versions of moment angle complexes. Buchstaber, Panoff, Nige Ray, Dietrich Notbaum. And then the way I started to learn about these things was through this really beautiful paper of Graham Denham and Alex Sushu. So they gave a very sensible definition of a moment angle complex together with some structure theorems. So let's start with the definition. So what are the ingredients here? Well, one is we're going to start off with a finite simplicial complex. Now, I know everybody knows the definition, but I'm happier to just put down some elementary facts in this lecture. So here's what I mean by a finite simplicial complex K. Start off with a set of integers from 1 to m. Oh, a finite simplicial complex with m vertices. So what do you mean by that? Start off with the set of integers from 1 to n, and K will be a subset of the power set. So it's just a set of subsets with the following property that if sigma is a subset and tau is contained in sigma, then tau is also in K. So in particular, I'm going to mention a completely trivial point. The empty set is in K. The empty set is required to be in K. That's a trivial point which comes up all the time in the proofs. Okay, so that's what a finite simplicial complex is. Let me give an example of a construction that I'm going to use in just a moment. So suppose K consists of the empty set, the set of 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, and 1, 3, in the power set of 1, 2, 3. So what do we have here? We've got a simplicial complex with three vertices. So I'm going to label those vertices as 1, 2, and 3. And then we have two edges, 1 and 3. So now it's going to be important to list certain subcomplexes. So for example, suppose we start off with I an element in K. So by this I mean an ordered K-tuple of integers which specifies a simplex in K. Then I want to look at K sub I, and this means the full subcomplex of K consisting of all simplices whose vertices, all simplices of K whose vertices lie in I. So I want to think of Ki as the full subcomplex of K of this form. And the reason I wrote down this picture is that if you look at I equal to 1, 2, then K sub I here is just the vertex 1 and 2 with the edge between them. So K sub I is that simplex. Okay? Now, so those are the ingredients concerning simplicial complexes. Now, the next ingredient is a pair of spaces, XA. And actually, in what follows, I'm going to start off with an M-tuple of pairs. So in this generalized sense, I'm going to start off with an M-tuple of pairs. And I'm going to assume that AI is a closed subcomplex of a CW complex, XI. So in other words, each XI is a finite CW complex, and AI is a closed subcomplex. That's the data. And now, from that, I want to make a construction which, you should correct me if I'm wrong. I think it's actually due to Neil Strickland. I want to define a space Z. So Z is going to depend on K, and this pair XA. But I'm being a little sloppy with notation. I actually want to use these M pairs of spaces, and I'll frequently write underline for the pairs of spaces, and this is going to be a subspace of X1 crossed X2 up to Xn. So I'm about to define a subspace of the product. I haven't done it yet, but I want to caution you, in the lecture, I may at sometimes goof up leaving off the underline, all right? So I'm now going to define what this space is, and it's equal to a union of spaces X sigma, where X sigma is a product Y1 up to Y sub M, where Yi is It's equal to xi if I is in sigma, and it's ai if I is not in sigma. And then I want to take the union over all simplices in k. So let me say this again. What we're doing is looking at a union of product spaces, y1 through ym. The factors are either ai or xi, and the factor is xi if I is in sigma. It's ai if I is not in sigma. So again, it's a very elementary construction. Now, do you know any nice examples of this? Well, the answer is for sure. So this is your question? Clear? So here's one connection to one of the main themes at this conference. So you can imagine fixing I equal to I1 through IK as a simplex of K. So now I want to look at LI, which is going to be a subspace of complex M space, where LI is defined by the ordered M tuples in C to the M, where ZI1 is ZI2, is ZIK 0 for, for this I. So in other words, you're going to consider this coordinate plane through the origin in complex M space. And now you can imagine looking at the union of these things, where I is not in K. Sorry, I goofed up. Well, we're just going to fix I1 through IK. We could look at the union of these coordinate planes in complex M space and now take the complement of the union of these coordinate planes. Now, what is that? It turns out it's one of these moment angle complexes. This is a homotopy equivalent to this moment angle complex on K and D2, S1. So this is one of those, well, I won't say it, but it's basically something very beautifully studied by Davis and Yanuskevich. So this is a classical fact, standard fact, that this generalized moment angle, or this moment angle complex, actually is a strong deformation retraction of complex M space minus a union of coordinate planes. So, for example, configurations in R2 are an example of one of these. So that's been one of the basic examples during a number of the talks here. So, so when Tony, Barry, Sam, and I started to play with these, we did something horrible to them. We mangled them in a very crude way. So to do that, I want to say what that crude mangling is in homotopy theory. So here's what I want to do. I want to start with, say, S1 cross S1. So that's a reasonable space. Inside of this, you can think of the wedge, namely S1 wedge S1. Now, what does that mean? That means two copies of the circle glued at a single point. So you can think of S1 wedge S1 as the axes in the product, S1 cross S1. And then what people like to do in homotopy theory is collapse the axes to a point. So you can imagine taking this the quotient, just collapsing the axes to a point. And what do you get out of this? Well, this is, for the purposes of homotopy theory, the two-sphere. So it's a mangled version of the two-sphere. So now what we're going to do is to find something called a smash product. So this is known as the smash product of S1 with S1. So now what I'd like to do is look at smash products and smashed moment angle complexes. So I'm going to do something horrible to these things. Namely, I want to think of this product of spaces, and there's a collapsing map from the product x1 crossed x2 up to xm to x1 smashed x2 smashed xm, where you can how can you possibly do this? How could you make the analog of the wedge? So I've kind of misled you. In order to do this, in order for this to make sense, in order for the wedge to make sense, you have to specify a base point in xi. So the ingredients now are actually going to be xi, ai, and a base point. So in order to even make sense of these crude constructions, you have to have a base point. Once you have a base point, this makes sense. And now, what can you say about this? Well, you could imagine looking at the moment angle complex as a subspace of the product. So this has been defined as a subspace of the product, and now you could imagine looking at the image in the smash product. So this is a subspace, and this is a quotient map, so you can imagine looking at the image, and then you could define the smash moment angle complex as the image. All right, so you can do something very simple, namely look at the moment angle complex into the product, and then collapse some stuff to a point, and we can call that the smash product moment angle complex. Now, why would you want to do this? Well, let's go back to this collapse map. Well, one thing you could ask, here's a map of topological spaces. Can you split that back? Can you map the two-sphere back to the torus? Well, everybody in here knows you cannot do that. But if you suspend these spaces once, in fact, you can split this back. And I just want to say that a classical observation is that S1 crossed S1 suspended once is homotopy equivalent to the suspension of S1 wedge S1 wedge the suspension of the two-sphere. So the torus cannot break apart in this way before suspending, but after suspending, it follows very easily. And so now, what I want to do is use this kind of process to see whether these smash product moment angle complexes fit with anything. And so now I'm going to start to state a few theorems. Well, So the first theorem in this direction is you could imagine looking at this moment angle complex. On the other hand, you could imagine looking at you could imagine fixing a simplex in M. Fix a simplex, and there's the associated moment angle complex for that. You could also consider the smash product moment angle complex. Now, these two spaces are very far apart. They're usually not homotopy equivalent, but when you suspend them once, they become homotopy equivalent. So that's true for any pair of CW complexes as long as A and X are finite and A is a closed subspace of X. Pardon me? I runs over all simplices in here. Now, what I want to say is that many of these are contractible. So this is just a formal bookkeeping device. And now what I'd like to do is illustrate what these contribute to the moment angle complex after you suspend it. So one case is where you assume that each xi is contractible. So that's the case in that example involving complements of coordinate planes in complex M space. And the theorem is then if you think of Ki, so remember, Ki is the simplicial complex, which is the full subcomplex of simplices, all of whose vertices are in I, and simplices are in K. Then this space is homotopy equivalent to the following. Let's see, the xi's are contractible, so now think of the geometric realization of this simplicial complex. Namely, for each simplex, put in a geometric simplex, take the union of those and glue them according to this simplicial complex, and now take the join of this with ai1 smashed with ai2 smashed with AIK, where I is I1 up through IK. So the first theorem is that if you think of the smash product moment angle complex, sorry about that, the topology of the smash product moment angle complex, in case each of these XIs are contractible, is just the join. It's the join of the geometric realization of Ki with these smash products. And that tells you that if that the suspension of Zk of Xa is the suspension of the wedge of these Ki's, so it's the join of the realization of Ki with the smash product of these things, and it's the wedge for I not in K. Now, how does this compare to standard results of, well, basically Mike Davis, Tadeusz Januszkiewicz, Goreski and McPherson? It tells you something straight away about what those guys did. Namely, let's look at the example of ZK of D2, comma S1. So by this I mean all of the XIs are D2, and the AIs are all the boundary of the D2s. So these are actually the moment angle complexes that Mike considered, for example. And what this tells you, well, it doesn't tell you anything about the moment angle complex itself, but it tells you that if you suspend it once, this is homotopy equivalent to the suspension of the wedge of, think of the KIs, take their geometric realization, join them with, well, what is A1 smashed with AK? Well, the AIs are all circles in this case. And we just saw in that example that if you take S1 smashed with S1, it's the two-sphere. So there's an induction here. S1 smashed with itself K times is the K-sphere. And so you have KI joined with the K-sphere. And this is for I not in K. So that tells you that this is the wedge of, well, the join of KI with the K plus 1 sphere suspended once is now the suspension K plus 2 times of the geometric realization of KI. Now, a theorem of Goreski and McPherson using stratified Morse theory is that the cohomology of the this particular moment angle complex is the cohomology of these pieces. And so what's happening is that by an alternative kind of playing off the geometry and homotopy theory, what you actually get is the moment angle complex splits apart into these pieces. So it tells you the cohomology splits apart, for example. But not just the cohomology, any cohomology theory, in a kind of a naive geometric way. Now, you could imagine replacing D2 by Dn plus 1. So you can imagine looking at the moment angle complex for Dn plus 1 and its boundary, and then suspending this once. And it turns out, well, if you apply the same formula, you get a similar answer. Namely, you get the suspension of the wedge over I not in K of the KIs, or the realizations of the KIs, joined with, this time instead of having a circle here, you've got the n-sphere. So you join this, you look at the smash product with the nk-sphere. So this tells you what all the pieces look like. And so if you just want to know about cohomology, what's happening is all these pieces look the same, apart from some suspension. Now, there's an analogous theorem if all AIs are contractible, then ZK of XA is homotopy equivalent to a point if K is not the M minus 1 simplex and it's the smash product of these X's if K is equal to the M minus 1 simplex. So this also tells you what happens with the other extreme. That is, if you consider the X's where the AIs are contractible. And here is where the Davis-Yanuskevich spaces come in. So I see I'm starting to run short on time, so I may go very quickly now. I want to look at something called the Davis-Yanuskevich space. And the Davis-Yanuskevich space is the following. Start off with the moment angle complex for the pair D2-S1. Well, now S1 acts on D2 by rotations. And so, in fact, you get an action of the M-fold product of S1s on this space. I'm going to call that Tm, and I'm going to cross this with a contractible free Tm space. And by Denham and Sushu, this is nothing more than the moment angle complex on CP infinity, comma, a point. And that's and so now you can ask about the cohomology of this. And it turns out the cohomology of this basically follows instantly from the fact that the AIs are contractible, and the cohomology of this turns out to be the Stanley-Reisner ring, the face ring. And that, in fact, works instead of some, well, it works essentially for any reasonable cohomology theory. Okay, now, what I wanted to do, or what I had planned to do, was rather than give some more theorems about moment angle complexes or proofs, I wanted to say where some of these things fit, because they seem to fit in some kind of amusing ways. So again, I'm going to say this very quickly. So, so there are a bunch. I think I'm going to try to restrict to two. Maybe with Jan Erik, I'll try to put in a third. So there are three interactions that I wanted to mention. One was with homotopy groups. So I was going to give this as a homework problem. The next one was motions of a robot. And the third one is analogs of braid groups. Logs of braid groups for any manifold M. So one of the things that we've looked at this conference are, braid groups on the plane or braid groups on CP1 or various things like that. Normally, braid groups are defined to be fundamental groups of configuration spaces, or at least the pure braid group is. So if the manifold is of dimension bigger than or equal to 3, you don't get much interesting new in the fundamental group of the configuration space. Indeed, you don't get anything new. So how can you imagine making a Braid group for a manifold of dimension bigger than 1? Or, sorry, or 3, sorry, bigger than 2. How can you imagine doing that? Well, this overlaps with something that Jan Erik was doing and Toshitake was doing. So let me say, I'm going to say this one quickly and first because you have to leave. So here's what you do. You start off with the manifold and you consider the configuration space of Q points on that manifold. Now, if the manifold were a surface, you would take its fundamental group and say that's the pure Braid group. If the manifold were R3, for example, the fundamental group is trivial, so you don't get anything. There's a different process that I'm going to describe which gives you a kind of Braid group. And that process is to look at its loop space. Well, how does the loop space or the configuration space correspond to Braids? Well, let's look at this in the case of M is R2. Well, what are you doing? You're looking at Q points in R2 which are distinct. What is the loop space of that? Well, these are functions from 0, 1 to this thing where they where these functions start here and they quit here. But in order for these things to be functions to the configuration space, what does this mean? At any time t, these the pictures cannot intersect. So in fact, what they are is if you think of the graph of something in here, the graph is precisely a pure braid. So if you think of the graphs of loops, those are exactly what you mean by pure braids, geometrically on the nose. So pi 0 of this, the path components, is exactly what the braid group is, or the pure braid group. But pi 0 of the loop space is pi 1 of the space. So that gives you the braid groups for R2. Well, if M is R3, you don't get anything from this. Here's how you can do it using the kind of things that you do. Namely, you could look at the homology and you could look at the maps of a tensor algebra on one generator and look at the coalgebra maps. This gives you a kind of pure braid group, and the group theory of this was developed years ago by Takeshi Sato, who studied this kind of construction. What this corresponds to geometrically is just lots of maps of a product of circles to the configuration space. So instead of a map of one circle, this thing corresponds to maps of a lot of circles. So I apologize for that quick digression, but we were going to talk about this briefly. Okay, so now I think what I'm going to do is quit in a few minutes by giving you a homework problem about homotopy groups and configurations. And then to end, I want to see how these things are giving motions of robot legs. Okay, so so we talked about these moment angle complexes as being subspaces of products. So, I mean, that was their definition. So you can imagine looking at projection maps out of these things. And that's what I want to look at next. In fact, I want to just specialize to the configuration space of Q points in R2. So you can imagine projecting to Q minus one configurations by just throwing away some coordinate. And there are clearly Q ways of doing that. Pick one. Now you can imagine looking at what happens on the level of the fundamental groups. And now I want to look at the kernel of this. I want to look at the kernel. The kernel is something I'm going to call Brun Q of R2. Now, you could have done the same thing for S2, namely S2 is R2 with a point at infinity added. So you have a map from pi 1 to these configurations, and then you could imagine looking at those and take the kernel again. And there's a map. Well, I think everybody in here knows that this map is a surjection. So you could ask, what is this map? Is that a surjection? Well, so that means you could look at the co-kernel. It's not hard to see that the image of this thing is normal in here. So in fact, you can form the quotient. And you could try to compute a couple of these. So when Q is equal to 5, the co-kernel is Z2. When Q is equal to 6, the co-kernel is Z2. When Q is 7, the co-kernel is Z12. And you could ask, what are those? Well, I don't know how to prove this using computations with the braid groups. So my homework question is, how can you decide that using the geometry of configurations in CP1 or R2? Is there a natural way to do that? This particular computation is based on joint work with John Barrick, Yan-Lai Wang, Ji Wu and myself, and it turns out that this co-kernel right here is pi q minus 1 of the 2-sphere, and Sarah in his thesis computed those groups. So there isn't much known about that. So here's an elementary question. What can you say about the co-kernel of this naive map? Okay. Now, the final thing that I want to mention is how these things fit with robotic motion of a certain flavor. Pardon me? Yes, right. So I'm now going to, so this is all moment angle business because the configuration space is, so these are all examples of some things you can do with these moment angle complexes. So the next one is going to be an example of something you can do with these generalized moment angle complexes, which Mike Davis and Ruth Charney cooked up. So count the number of legs. So you see, oops. How did I manage to do that? So you see you have six legs, and they're not really in full motion. What they correspond to is think of this as a leg. Well, maybe use this end. Here's the foot of the leg. So you can imagine this leg moving around in a circle. And so I'm going to give another picture in just a moment where the leg is allowed to move more freely. But notice one of the features is that if you had three legs on one side all off the ground, this thing would tip over. So you want to avoid having three legs up in the air at the same time. So now, I'm going to show you and try to show you another one. Oh, that, oops, that's not the right one. Oh, yes, here it is, the YouTube one. Okay, and then, got it, yeah.
And then make it big.
Oh, yes. Oh, how do you make, oh. Okay. So, you see this thing has six legs and they're moving around in a full circle. So, you could ask yourself, what does this have to do with moment angle complexes? And, maybe what I could do is keep the picture going and then state the theorem. So what's the theorem? So suppose you think of ZK and S1, comma, E plus, where E plus is the upper hemisphere, then the position of these robot legs is the space of positions of the legs is homeomorphic to this, where K is the one skeleton of the five simplex. So that's an easy example. This is actually joint work with the initial ingredients of some joint work with some non-topologists, namely Dan Kodachek and Rob Greist and myself, where we're trying to understand some of what Mike and Ruth Charney did, but then putting in some additional geometry into these spaces. So what I want to say is that these moment angle complexes touch on a lot of things for pretty easy reasons. But what would be nice is if somebody could come up with a solution for some things. Well, thank you very much, and I wish Peter a happy birthday. Thank you. Mike. Right, so it turns out that if you make a, just change some variables, write the ZIs as XI minus XJ, then you can take N things, choose two, and do it that way. So that's one way to do it. There are other ways. I probably didn't say that very clearly, but maybe we should do it on paper after. Right, right. So they connect up with a lot of things, and in particular, I'd be very curious if people could explain some of the features of this co-kernel. So if you just think of R2 and S2, and think of the co-kernel of maps from these Brunian braids, it turns out that co-kernel is always a finite abelian group. It turns out there are no elements of order 8 in it, and there are no elements of order p squared for p and odd prime. There are infinitely many elements of order p, of order 2, and order 4. Is there some geometry behind p1 that's hiding this? Okay, well, thank you.
More questions?
Oh, you just look at what the definition is, and then you get a map, and it's not hard to see that it's a homeomorphism. The trouble with working with some engineering folks is they've changed the conditions a little bit. It's hard to talk with one another. That's the hardest part of proving your theorem. So you just make a map.